everyone. Welcome to Harnessing Your Wealth. I'm your substitute host today, along with Cade Peterson on the show. And we have a very special guest today. And we brought him on because, well, he owns the company and he's also been around a long time. He's got some great experience to share. And we want to dive into that, basing it around recent market highs and specifically in the technology and AI space of the market. And Billy, I'm going to introduce you right here. Everyone, welcome Billy Peterson to the show. Good to have you, Bill.
Wow. I hear the applause right now as we speak. Thank you, Sean. It's such an honor. Such an honor.
Good. Glad to have you. Bill, your career started back in your second career, but career in the financial services industry started back in 1996, right?
Yep, that's correct. I mean, it was the end of 96, but I was pursuing my license, if you will, in this industry. I was pursuing my career while I was phasing out of the other one. So I was still riding racehorses at the time, primarily at Los Alamitos back in those days, at the last year of my career, and night racing. It taken a toll on me. You know, a lot of people ask, why did you retire? Kind of the pinnacle of your career there. I was just really doing well. It had become fairly popular in the industry, getting a lot of recognition and good horses to ride. But I'll just tell you, I had finally hit that point in my life where I'd starved myself for so long and taken such a beating on just keeping my weight down. And then the nonstop grind of being at the racetrack by 6 a.m., working horses, and then leaving, going to the brokerage firm, trying to get some experience in that industry for several hours, and then back to the track from 7 p.m. to 11. You know, that's a line in Case of Shadow, if you haven't seen that movie. But I finally got to the end of the rope, Sean. It was time to give it up.
Yeah, I love your story. I know you share it with us in the office all the time. And you also like to remind us of how different financial services industry was in those days. And I mean, you're kind of coming off the roaring 90s, right? The market did so well in the 90s and it led up to a kind of a historic event, right? You had the 99, 2000, early 2000s, the tech bubble. And I think we're seeing a lot on the news. They're drawing a lot of comparisons to that and saying, hey, is this recent rally, is it similar to that? But maybe you could bring our viewers back and tell us a little bit, like, what was that time like? You know, you're a fresh advisor, the tech rally's going, like, bring us back. Tell us what it was like.
Yeah, it's fun being in my seat now for a little while because I can look back and I can share my experiences with you guys. And I know a lot of times I do it unsolicited and you probably get sick of hearing it, but it is interesting in my opinion, because it was so much different then and running a business. I mean, I sat in a cubicle with 12 other fledgling advisors, all trying to grind it out and make a career of it. And of course they come in and I had absolutely no clients. They gave me a desk, a computer, and a phone. And they said, here you go, sink or swim. But by the way, you have 2 years to hit this asset level that we've decided for you. And if you don't hit it, you're out. So I had that going for me. And we all knew the pressure was on. And I will tell you that the attrition rate in this industry is about 65% failure in year one. And by year two, 80% of the advisors have fallen out and they just couldn't cut it. It's a tough grind. But to your question, what was it like back then building a business? Well, it was just the infancy of the internet. Internet was coming along and was starting to see applications, starting to see what potential there was for these businesses in the world. And they all had some new idea, new spin on it. Now, you had the companies that created the infrastructure, the picks and shovels, if you will. And then you had the companies that were trying to sell things online. So think Amazon or pets.com or stamps.com or flowers.com or whatever it was, companies that had zero earnings or zero revenue. It was essentially just an idea or a concept. And they would be welcomed with open arms into the stock market, into the world of capital deployment. They would become the new darling IPO. Almost on a daily basis, we were seeing IPOs, which is, for those of you who don't know, initial public offering. And so these companies would find investment banking firms, and the shares were just like gold. I remember as an advisor, you were dying to get your hands on shares of these IPOs because you would almost guarantee the stock price would jump up by 50% day one. I mean, it was just clockwork. And some of them were going up 200 or 300% in their first day of trading. And it made no sense to me. I couldn't understand what was going on. I didn't understand the valuation disparity. So I started reading Buffett and other people who were not following that to try to get a different look or a different view. Like, what was I missing? But then you'd have all the analysts, of course, all the investment banking firms and a lot of the brokerage firm analysts pounding the table on all these companies because they had skin in the game. There was a conflict of interest, but very few people could see it. They were compensated based on how many of these companies they helped bring public. So it was always the public investor, the retail investor, who ended up getting screwed in the end with a lot of these companies that had no business going public, selling their business to the public shareholders.
And I'm sure there were a lot of advisors back then, or so-called gurus, that thought that was the next age, all these small dot-com companies. Did you know any advisors personally that went out of business during that time?
Oh, yeah. There were a lot. I mean, heck, I remember being in the training class. And so in my training class, this, remember, I'm just fresh from retiring as a jockey. So I'm still this skinny little guy with a suit bagging off of, I used to buy my suits at the boys section. You know, I couldn't find one that would fit me. I had a 26 inch waist. I weighed 106 pounds at my lowest. Yeah, I was an anorexic, if you guys didn't know that. But I was back in New Jersey for the training. This was 2-3 weeks after I'd retired. And I certainly need to say this, the food was endless. I was endless. And I just wanted to make up for all those lost meals. So I was pounding the food like you can't believe. But what I saw there was so many different advisors who had the idea of how they were going to position themselves as an expert. And I remember one night when we were asked to call, we were supposed to bring a list of 50 prospects to this training. So at night, after we had taken classes all day long, and it gets about 7 p.m. on the East Coast, and now we're supposed to pull out our prospect list and start dialing people at night while they're at home. So got your phone numbers, you start calling. And that was scary, of course, but the trainers were there to critique you on how well you did positioning yourself as a professional and trying to solicit new clients into your advisory capacity so you could help them. But a guy next to me was talking about tech stocks and things that I'd never even heard of, but he was sounding like the craziest salesperson I've ever heard. And I thought, listening to him, I don't want anything to do with this. I don't want anything to do with this kind of, if this is what it is, get me out. I don't think I can handle this kind of thing. But there were a lot that they just fell off. I knew that for a fact, guys like that weren't going to make it because they're just selling stuff, you know, sell stock and then to a customer and then have them buy it, try to get them to sell it a few days later, make another commission. I saw so many different advisors with different viewpoints of how to handle clients' investment dollars. And fortunately, even though I made my share of mistakes, I steered clear of that. And I always felt like taking the high road to the client and making sure that they were getting good advice, but not just trading things. Because what I learned is buying good companies and holding them for the long term is how you make money over the long term.
With that tech bubble, let's call it, back in the day, I mean, how did that all end? What happened?
Well, it was kind of like the first card started to fall off. And as you know, when you have a house built of cards, there's nothing solid underneath it. And you started to see a few of these companies that were not measuring up to the sales expectations. All right. And then you started to see a little bit more of a collapse. And then you had 9/11. Now 9/11 was almost like, you know, the arrow in the balloon, and it popped.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody started running away. So it's like risk off, we used to call it. People wanted their money back. They didn't want to have exposure to risk assets or assets that can change in value so quickly. And that was one of the big contributors to the fallout. And it, once it happened, it was relentless. Tech stocks dropped, as we all know now, looking back, about 80%. It took more than a decade for the NASDAQ to get back to its old high from that low. Matter of fact, I remember hearing a lot of people say it would never get there again. No, right. I didn't believe that. Because people say never, you know, that's always a fallacy. But things always climb in value. That's just the nature of inflation and pricing pressure. So the Dow and NASDAQ, all those, yeah, the Dow will be 100,000 in our lifetime, no doubt about it.
Right. And living through that and having that experience, I'm sure you have some battle scars, of course, but you learned a lot, and you probably look at what we're going through right now with this, you know, tech boom, this AI boom, let's call it. That's the hot word on the street right now. Are there similarities, or how are we viewing what we're looking at and what we're investing in for clients? Walk me through that a little bit.
Well, back in the internet boom, I would say the majority of the companies were without earnings. There wasn't anything really behind them. So it was all psychological. It was based on a perception of something of value. And people wanted, like I said, they wanted these IPOs. It was a treasure box. And the mindset shifted from something of what's behind this curtain, and can I analyze it? And does this thing actually have sales or employees or a building that it owns? You know, what's the assets? If we stripped away everything else and had to just sell it off for its parts, what's behind that? And you found out most of the time it was nothing. It was a smoke and mirrors. It was a facade. And you know, I'll say it right now. I'll compare that to the crypto thing right now. All these cryptos are a facade. There's nothing behind them. The NFTs are a facade. You know, we're allowing people out there to build up hype, and it's creating such buzz and such this fear of missing out that the price just continues to really move higher and higher and higher based on nothing more than psychological events. And that's what was going on in the internet boom. And the subsequent bust was, oh, I guess we do have to value companies, and price does matter in the end. There are only a few that had earnings, and those most, for the most part, survived. Amazon was in infancy back then, but they were actually making money. Now, they weren't profitable. They weren't in the black because they had borrowed so much money just to get their infrastructure built out. Think about the cost of the warehouses and the shipping and all of the things that it took them to get going. But the future, and a lot of people could see this, is they had such tremendous potential because they were so widely adopted, and they stayed ahead of the curve on what it was going to require to become profitable. And they borrowed money at the right time, and they did the right thing. They were smart. So Bezos had a concept, had an idea, and he made it work. He grew into that valuation. But others, most of the others, actually flopped, and it was a complete disaster. So a lot of people investing in those businesses that were the speculative ones, they lost it all. And that's where we all hear, I'll never invest in the stock market again. I invested and I lost everything.
Right.
Well, those are the kind of companies that created that.
Well, I also think, and I can imagine, you know, going back and hearing the way you describe it, that everyone wanted to be all in, you know, on this upswing. I want all in. They're expecting double digit plus returns. And so they forget one of the most key principles investing, which is diversification, which is what we practice here. We're not just going to put everyone in one tech stock, or we're not just going to load up. I mean, you have to understand that concept, because you know, when you get greedy, you can get really, really burnt. So, you know, building a diversified portfolio is so prudent right now. And you can't let that greed overtake, you know, just your common sense, right?
Yeah. But it's hard to go against the grain.
Oh, definitely.
Think back to the movie. What was that movie called? The Big Short. Yeah, The Big Short. Let me think about those guys who were actually right. They were dead right, but they look like absolute fools for how long? Because they were betting against this mortgage boom and this housing boom, and they were saying, this does not have any legs to stand on. There's no justification for the prices. There's no justification for these things to be trading like they are. And so they went completely out on a limb, and they started to question themselves after a while. And they were the lone wolf. But in the end, look at what happened. They were the ones that actually proved to be the right.
Right.
Yet all these other so-called geniuses, where are they now? They were always on the television, always on these news programs, touting how this time is different. Subprime mortgages, selling this package and that package, and buying these spec homes was just the new way to make money. Everybody wanted a hand in it. There was no lending protocols anymore. It was just, you know, lending requirements just went out the window. Anybody with a pulse could get money.
Yeah.
And that's what frustrates me, is knowing, going through my whole career and seeing how many of these occurrences have transpired with these new trends of speculation, whether it is, I don't care, go back thousands of years. You can go clear back to the tulip bulb mania, to the Dutch East Indies trading company. Okay, you can come out now to the oil explosion in the 70s, 80s. You can go to the real estate explosion. And now you can look at the crypto. And those of you who are out there saying, yeah, that's different. Well, that's exactly what you'd say. So therein proves my point. Because there's no justification for those valuations. Not one.
I was in Arizona for a weekend a couple weeks ago, and I was sitting in a hot tub, and there was another guy there, and he asked me what I did for a living. And I told him, and the first thing he said, you hear about this Bitcoin ETF? And yeah, I heard about it. If I were you, I'd be loading up on that thing. And as soon as I heard that, it made me feel like this thing could be a serious bubble. So,
well, and that's a great point, Cade, because that's the average retail investor out there right now. They're looking at it. They see on the internet, the social posts of all the different social media platforms and all these so-called experts and geniuses. Everybody's touting what they're doing and investing and how they're making the crypto and they're making fortunes. And now they've got the hashtag, what is it? Have fun staying broke or something like that. If you're not into crypto, because you're a fool, you're an idiot, you're a moron, you don't get it. That was the same thing they said during the real estate buildup, the same exact thing. And I remember 100% to this day, Warren Buffett getting on saying, this is an absolute bubble. And I remember hearing the next day on CNBC, some guy laughing at him. Warren Buffett has no idea what he's talking about. He's too old to understand the valuations of real estate is this and that and the other. They don't make any more of it. Okay, so we hear the same thing now, just a little bit different flavor with crypto and Bitcoin. And Bitcoin is going to be the currency of the future. Okay, let me ask you this, guys. How many people do you know that use Bitcoin actually as a currency?
None.
I don't know of any. Zero. What they do with it, though, is they purchase it. And when they purchase it for what reason?
They hope it goes up in value. Yeah,
they think it's an investment. So if you think it's an investment, why would you want to use it as a currency, Sean? Why would you want to give any of it away?
I don't have a good answer for that.
So the whole point I'm making is, if it's the new currency, that's a contradiction right there. There is no way you can have a currency when no one's willing to trade it. No one's willing to use it. All right. And the only way they use it is in these underground criminal activities, sometimes in transactions and wallets and numbers. You don't even know who belongs to who. Unless you want to go out there and state it and put it out there for the public to see. So,
yeah. And you better hope your crypto is not sitting on an exchange that goes broke, because well, we all see that happen, right?
We
all saw how that panned out here recently. Let's wind it back to today, and let's kind of talk about what we're seeing in the market right now. Where do you think we're headed from here? And I know you don't have a crystal ball, and I'm not asking you to, but what are we looking at here at the firm?
Well, we look at this every day. Those are here listening. I'm telling you right now, we take this seriously. I've gone through some of these ups and downs, and I grew up on a farm, and I know the value of hard work. And I know that I always felt like the harder I worked, the luckier I got. And that just comes from what I think is how you attract things to you by putting in the time and effort. And so we put in the time. We value all of our relationships, the people that work with us. We want to do the right thing. The right thing is a lot of times doing nothing. Now that sounds kind of strange, but people that want to get too active in their investment strategies oftentimes end up hurting themselves. And what we're doing is looking at companies that can sustain it for the long term. I prefer to buy individual stocks whenever possible, if it's appropriate for the client on their risk tolerance, and hold them for a long period of time. Mm-hmm. Right now, Sean, I think the question that most people want to know is this sustainable? Most of the run-up in this market has been due to the Magnificent Seven, we call them. And you guys will need to help me a little bit. Amazon, NVIDIA, Microsoft, Alphabet.
Facebook.
Meta, yeah.
Meta.
Tesla. And so big gains, like outsized gains for those companies. By far and away, the largest contributors to the S&P 500 returns. If you take those seven out, matter of fact, the S&P's returns dropped by about 70% or more. Mm-hmm. Because that's how impactful they've been. NVIDIA alone has been on an absolute tear. And that's the company that's kind of the darling child of the artificial intelligence movement. They make the chips that are embedded in all of these technology systems, software programs that allow the machines to learn. Now, just think about that for a minute. Does that sound a little scary to you?
Sounds like a couple Will Smith movies I've seen. Robots are going to take over.
It sounds like the Jetsons back when I was a kid. Okay. Yeah. That was fun. I like that. But now it's actually becoming real. Mm-hmm. So these computers learn and they understand and they make a mistake and then they change and they adapt. And all this stuff is going to be, we're going to have to learn to live with it somehow. People are kind of asking questions. Is it going to take my job away? Can I trust it? Well, I don't know. I don't know how that's all going to pan out, but I know that there's a lot of money being made in that space, but there's going to be some volatility, Sean. I mean, just going back to these other periods of time when you see the markets get stretched, sometimes they get stretched way further than you expect. And I always say, I'm not too worried about the market having a big correction as long as there's skepticism in the market. And I see that right now. I see a lot of people who are looking at it, but not really wanting to commit, invest in it. They're kind of on the outside looking in. There's still a lot of hesitancy. But when you see grandma and grandpa jumping in and they want to buy NVIDIA and they've heard about it. And,
yeah.
Hey, my grandson told me, okay, that's when you need to start getting concerned. That's when the bubble is about to burst. That's what happened time and time again.
That's a great point. And Billy, you and I were talking yesterday and we were looking at calendar year returns of NVIDIA. And in 2022, when all those companies sold off, it was down like what, 60%?
Yeah.
And so that brings home the whole point of you can't load up just in one or two or seven companies if you don't have a diversified portfolio. And yeah, they may not all be firing at the same time and heading up. Just like you said, a lot of the S&P 500 stocks have not experienced near the returns. And to me, that gets me excited. That means there's some room for some opportunity if you're looking for value in the market. It's out there, but it also takes the goal and the going against the grain to take some profits from these companies that have run up and spread it across these other ones. And that's some of the most difficult decisions that we make here in the office is pulling some of that back right? And saying, hey, we need to bring this back down to earth, make it the right percentage in the model. And you know, that's what we're trying to do every single day. Maybe going to shift gears here just a little bit, because this is also a question we get. Hey, it's an election year. Doesn't that mean the market's going to crash? Share your thoughts on that, because I know I've been through plenty of election cycles. I know you have. Let's talk a little bit about that. Give us your thoughts.
Well, when I was in college, I was getting my advanced degree at UTEP, so Texas El Paso, and I was going there so I could continue to ride racehorses. That was my number one goal, riding at Sunland Park. But I remember the president during my tenure at UTEP was Bush the first, and seemed to be a pretty mellow guy. And I know that it was kind of like my first exposure to politics was listening to Reagan. And I always felt like that guy was just so likable, and it was just fun to hear him talk. And he was jovial, and see, most people seem to respect him, like him, even if they weren't affiliated with his party. Fast forward to now, I think we've got so much tension and hatred. Why is that happen? I'll tell you why. Media. The media, if we could get rid of the media, I think the entire system of our country would work better. Now, it's scary because you can't just say, well, we don't want to have any source of news. But you know how the things work. They over-dramatize everything, and they want eyeballs, and it's all become a profit center. And I look at that, and it seems so corrupt to me. There's no good news. You can't turn on the nightly news and hear Walter Cronkite or somebody that just gives you the straight up facts of what's going on around the world. No, they've got to paint it with their picture, with their narrative, with their view of who they want to support. And then you're supposed to buy into that. And that's what's going on also with universities. And that's scary to me. I don't know. I think this country's got a lot to worry about. And the media is by far and away the biggest problem.
Does the election make you worry about the stock market?
No. So, and I know that's where you were going, but I always have to throw my 2 cents in on everything.
I love your 2 cents, Bill.
No, it doesn't. So that, you know, guys, Sean, you've been with the firm since 2012, right?
11,
sorry. And Cade's been here for now 4 years, I think. And so we've had elections. You always have, every 2 years, you've got some kind of major election, whether it's the midterms, okay, for the congressmen, for the politicians. I don't have much good to say about them. Or you have the 4-year term with the presidential election. And again, I don't have much good to say there. It's just always such animosity. But with the market, what are we investing in? Strip it all away and say, am I investing based on the policies of one person or the administration that's going to be running the country? Is that really all this is? Let's say, for example, if I own a business, if I own a construction company or an electric company or a whatever you want to, I don't care, a convenience store. Are you going to sell your company because somebody was elected as president that you don't agree with? Is it done? Are you over? Are you quitting? Are you folding up to your tent? I mean, no. So you have to treat that the same way with your investments. You don't just dump them. And we can go back in time, look at every single presidential cycle and the annual returns for the market. Companies find a way to get through no matter what, no matter who's the president is or yeah, Congress.
That average returns 11% in election years for the S&P.
Yeah, that's pretty dang good if you just step back and quit worrying. But a lot of people worry. They let their emotions control their decisions. We've had a number of clients who do that. They get so emotional and they get so glued to the CNN or whoever else they're watching, Fox News, whoever they're watching, that they can't see through the fog. And they want to react to it. And reaction is the enemy of a successful investor.
Yeah, it really comes down to managing emotion and not letting emotion guide your investment decision, whether it's negative emotion or even positive emotion. you know, sometimes people fall in love with one company or one sector, and you've got to find a way to rein that in. And I'll say, I think we do a great job of that here. And we do it because we understand our clients and the way they're thinking, and we help kind of bring that all back to reality and point out things like you said. Look at this company. Here are their earnings. Here is the product that they provide, the services they provide, how many employees they have. Here's their board of director. I mean, that's what I'm looking at when I'm looking for opportunity in the market. And I don't look at it on, okay, well, I think we're going to hold this company for 1 year and then boom, we're out of here, guys. We're going to make a profit. We say it all the time in the office. When we invest in a company, we're planning to hold it forever. That's the idea. That if mm-hmm. we did our job right, we hold that thing for 10, 15, 20 years. Yeah. And does it always work out like that? No, there's been some where, hey, we didn't make the right decision. We need to do something else. But
well, let me go back on that just to kind of prove your point. You guys have heard me talk about this before, but if you had invested $2,000 in Walmart when it came public in 1972, $2,000, I'm talking about buying 100 shares, wasn't even 2000. You know, you're putting maybe $1,700 into it to get yourself 100 shares.
Right.
Okay. If you just hold that and never added one more dime to it, let your dividends reinvest, you've got over $40 million in value today.
Yeah.
Okay. So
how many presidential election cycles did we have, or wars, or inflation? I mean, you can think of all the different things that went on from that 1972 point to today.
And I'll promise you, there were dozens of periods when Walmart stock dropped 20% or more. Guaranteed. From peak to trough. Here's another one. Here's another fun one. And this has to do with the folks that are afraid of making a mistake, or they're going to buy the companies that are terrible. Let's say, for example, that you decided to get into the market in 1999, right before the market blew up in tech space, mm-hmm. and you bought five stocks. And you put $5,000 in each one of these five. Now, let me give you the five. You bought Washington Mutual, Lehman Brothers,
oh boy,
Enron,
oh boy,
WorldCom,
oh God,
and NVIDIA. Okay, so you bought five companies. They all damn good businesses at the time, 1999. They were all doing very well. Other than NVIDIA, because NVIDIA just went public. It was a brand new startup chip design company. But the other ones were pretty well established. All right, so you're 5,000, you fast forward a few more years, going to the real estate collapse. And by then, guess what? You got to be the unluckiest investor in the history of the world. Because Sean, 80% of your companies are now out of business.
And went broke.
What a terrible, terrible investor you are. So you're 4 out of 5, all broke. But you're still holding on to your $5,000 investment from NVIDIA. Today, your investment there has turned into 19,000 shares, over 19,000 shares with the splits, which now equates to over $15 million in value. So that $5,000 took care of all the other. So your $25,000 total investment grew to $15 million. I'm not sure if that's any good. In a 25-year period.
I would say that is pretty good. It's pretty good.
Pretty good. So this is kind of just the example of buying and holding. Even if you have some losers like that, and hopefully you don't ride this into the ground. If you have an advisor worth his salt, you're going to probably avoid a lot of those mistakes.
For sure. And we're definitely not telling anyone to go out there and pick five stocks and see you later.
No.
There's a lot that goes into that. Like, what are your goals? You know, do you need income? Do you need wealth accumulation? How's your risk tolerance? Like you're looking at all that before we're recommending anything. But I love that example, Billy. It really just shows you, hey, you know, buy and hold. There's going to be ups and downs.
But you want to have companies with earnings, right, Sean? So
yeah,
this is the separate story. I read a story yesterday that now there are millions of people in our country alone who are betting or relying on Bitcoin to make them wealthy, or to get them to their promised land, so to speak. That's their only hope. Mm-hmm. You know, they might have had $1,000 or a couple thousand dollars. That's all they had saved up. They're getting by paycheck to paycheck. that's what they're going to pump it into. That's their gamble. That's, and it, to them, it's not even a gamble. It's like, this is it. This is what I'm going to do. Yeah. I am so, so scared for people. I don't know when this party is going to end. I don't know when, how it's going to look, but like you asked me before, what started it? There's going to be some cataclysmic event or some kind of falling of the initial card that brings this whole thing down. We're going to look back on it and they're going to write books on this stuff. Just like they did on the tulip bulb mania. You know, back then people seriously thought the same thing. Tulip bulbs were the future. Put their whole life wealth into bulbs. They hadn't even grown into a tulip yet. This was the mentality. This is how almost deranged people can become in something. And it's all under this shell of technology. So people don't understand it. Therefore, it's got to be worth a lot because I apparently understand it and you don't.
Yeah.
And that's the problem.
Yeah. It makes for interesting conversation. And, you know, I've always enjoyed, even when I first stepped foot in the office, hearing your stories and kind of how you, you know, saw how other people in the business were not doing it right. They weren't doing right by their client, and how you built this up to where the firm is a client first approach. You know, we're fiduciaries. The client's needs are before ours, and we're trying to structure models around that. So I love your stories all the time. I know sometimes they're unsolicited, but
all the time me, unsolicited.
Yeah, we're listening and we're gaining knowledge from all that. So
you guys don't know how it was because I have to share with you my experience so you learn and won't make the same mistakes because I made all the mistakes. So you don't have to. You know what it was like when I was back in the training program? This is what it was like, Sean. They would tell us, here, work on your sales pitch. Here, you got to go. You're going to a lady's house and she's giving you an appointment. You're sitting down at a kitchen table. You've got to get her an account. What are you going to sell her? So this guy gets up there. He's the instructor. He says, all right, I pull out the stock certificate. Philip Morris. Look at this, man. Philip Morris. This company's been around for 60 years plus, paying a dividend of 4.5%. You can't go wrong. The dividend's been raised every year. Go on with this slick sales pitch. And then the lady stops for a second and says, well, sir, don't they make cigarettes? Well, yeah, that's what they do. They're very profitable, ma'am. Well, my husband just died of lung cancer.
Oh,
and he reaches into his other pocket and he pulls out stock certificate for Amgen. Look here, ma'am, I've got this stock. This is Amgen. They make cancer fighting drugs. I'd like you to invest in this. So you just keep on going. You never let anybody slow you down. And that's that. That's what they taught us. That's how they taught us to get into this business. You guys are, you don't know how lucky you are to have me as the torchbearer to run through that, make sure you didn't have to deal with what I did.
Well, thanks for taking the beating for us, Bill. We're always so appreciative of it.
The old back in my day cliche.
It was a time. It was a time.
Here.
Now, when you went to school, was it uphill both ways?
Well, it was very, very difficult. You guys don't know. I run to the track, back to school, change in between, back to the track. Now, every track that I was at, not just Los Al, but it was Sunland Park. It was wherever I was at, always school. First track, back to the track, back to school, maybe get a little bit of sleep, maybe a couple hours of sleep at night. It was never ending, relentless.
Gosh, Sean, I've never heard that before. Have you?
No, I've never heard that one.
You guys have first, it so easy. I mean, first. Even do in the office doing trades, you know, when you guys need to invest some money or make some changes in a client's account, it's all technology. Boom, you push a button and it's done. I had to actually physically write these things out on what's called a stock ticket. Okay. And then rip off the top sheet, run it up to what's called the cage, put it into the cage, and then have them enter it. You had to get it in on time or you weren't going to get the trade done in time. And then you had to keep records of everything to produce it at the end of the month for the manager to review. It was a much different world, guys.
Way different time. Well, I'm glad we take the planning approach with clients. And I think that's so much, much more valuable than just the running the tickets to the cage and hope it gets executed.
For sure. If there's any takeaway here, it's long-term, it's planning, it's staying the course and having a good idea of where you're going and if you're going to be able to get there. And the way we set up the business now, that's what we're trying to help people accomplish.
Good. Well, let's wrap it up right there and hope everyone enjoyed the show here. And I guess I'm thanking you, Bill, for letting me be the host on your own show. Cade and I, that was a good time. We'll have to do it more often. And please, all the listeners out there, you'll share this with your friends, Harnessing Your Wealth podcast. It's available on all major platforms, or you can check us out at petersonws.com. And hope you enjoyed the show. Thanks for tuning in.
Thank you for listening to Harnessing Your Wealth with Billy Peterson. Before we declare the race official, please click the follow button so you can be notified when new episodes become available. For more information about today's show, please check out the show notes. Visit our website at www.petersonws.com or give us a call at 801-475-4002. Once again, thank you for listening. The information covered and posted represents the views and opinions of the guest and does not necessarily represent the views or opinions of Peterson Wealth Services. The content has been made available for informational and educational purposes only. The content is not intended to be a substitute for professional investing advice. Always seek the advice of your financial advisor or other qualified financial service provider with any questions you may have regarding your investment planning.